Okay, we might get started. So thank you for coming on this very cold day. My name's Julian Savulescu and I'm the Uehiro Chair in Practical Ethics. It's a great pleasure to welcome you to the third and final Uehiro Lecture for 2010, delivered by Professor Masaki Ichinose from Tokyo University. The theme of the lectures has been modes of responsibility, and tonight it will be the death penalty and human rights. Program is Masaki will talk for roughly 50 minutes, and then there'll be 40 minutes for questions, followed by a wine reception. But if you feel that you can't wait in the middle, you can get up and get a glass of wine now or after. But welcome, Masaki.
Thank you very much for attending my talk, despite being bitterly cold today. In today's talk, I will mention the philosophy of John Locke. But as you know, John Locke is a kind of a symbol of a superstar in the philosophy of Oxford. So I'm afraid that my talk would be like carrying coals to Newcastle. So actually, I had a lunch together with Professor Williamson today, and I talked with him about such kind of things. Anyway, but I hope my argument would make sense, somehow make sense for Oxford people, even for Oxford people. Let me start. Like the previous two talks, I will follow my script projected in the screen. Of late, two-thirds of all countries in the world, including UK, institutionally or virtually, have already abolished the death penalty. Nevertheless, the death penalty still deserves discussing. There are two reasons. As a matter of fact, there are countries where the death penalty is retained, like US, Japan, or China, and always cause controversies, domestically or internationally. And even in countries in which the death penalty has been already abolished, some people sometimes hope to revive the death penalty, particularly when a quite horrible crime is carried out. I have heard that even British people sometimes hope to revive the death penalty. As far as the death penalty is actually taken to be the ultimate punishment, we could expect to clarify the significance of the system of punishment in general through examining the death penalty. An acquittal sentence and a death sentence constitute both extreme ends of sentencing and punishment, 0 and 1, as it were, so that we could draw the outer frame of the system of punishment by analyzing the death penalty. Analogous to the concept of probability, the Kolmogorov axiom, in which there is an axiom concerning the probability 1. The probability 1 is defined as the probability of the whole sample space. We need to comprehend what the probability 1 is in order to understand the concept of probability in general. Analogously, it seems we needed to figure out how the death penalty should be dealt with in order to make sense of what the system of punishment in general should be. The public opinion of Japanese people at present strongly supports the death penalty, as is shown by the result of a public opinion poll conducted by the Japanese government in 2009. 85.6% of Japanese people, support the retention of the death penalty. Maybe it is politically and morally valid for Japan to retain the death penalty according to the principle of democracy. However, the surprising result seems to be only based upon the reluctant agreement to the retention of the death penalty, because most of them only agree with the option which said that it is unavoidable to impose or to inflict the death penalty in some cases. In Japan, the citizen judge system began in last year, in which ordinary people take part in judicial decisions, including death sentences. A newspaper company carried out a public opinion poll with regard to this new system of citizen judge, including a questionnaire about whether they can announce the death sentence by themselves as a citizen judge or not. Only 48.8% of people answered they can announce that. Probably if the poll included included as well, questionnaire about whether they can execute criminals on death row by themselves or not, the percentage of the answer yes would radically fall down. What does this result suggest? People who support the death penalty, positively or reluctantly, seems to regard that as a behavior suiting justice. Nevertheless, the more directly they come to have to take part in that by themselves, the more hesitant they feel to do so, to do that. Why? One of the most reasonable answers to this question is that they perceive killing persons, no matter what reasons there are, and justice not to be perfectly compatible. There is no doubt that the people's honest feeling concerning the death penalty is not determined, but indeterminately wavered. On the one hand, the death penalty sounds somehow morally just, but on the other hand, it looks to be avoided. I'm intuitively sure that this Japanese circumstance surrounding the death penalty could be generalized. I'm philosophically interested in this wavering uncertainty, as this uncertainty seems to suggest a peculiar kind of ambivalence over the death penalty. I will aim at analyzing what this peculiar kind of ambivalence is. I believe that this argument could give some clue to the general issue of punishment, firstly because the death penalty constitutes the ultimate punishment. The second cause, second reason, some kind of ambivalence could be applied to any punishment as well. To impose punishment, particularly to do it in a physical sense, like custody, sometimes tends to cause an ambivalent feeling. It looks to agree to the rule of justice, while simultaneously we might doubt whether this is a desirable way or not. One of our philosophical tasks about the issue of punishment should be to clarify the nature of the ambivalence. Back to Locke. In discussing the ambivalence over the death penalty in the Freud, I will presuppose 2 points. I take it for granted that the present system of the death penalty is based upon the modern theory of human rights or the concept of the person. This is absolutely true of Japanese legal system as well. Because the respect for fundamental human rights and the principle of nulla poena sine lege, no punishment without law, are clearly stated in the Constitution of Japan. Thus, it is logically implied that the system of punishment, including the death penalty, ought to be based upon the theory of human rights. As far as we presuppose this first point, we should set aside some pre-modern or medieval views that sound inconsistent with the theory of human rights, like Bushido or samurai spirit in Japan, or the frontier spirit in early Americans. I set aside such kind of views. Officially speaking, we have to regard human rights or the concept of person as the basis of legal system, as long as we are living in constitutional states. And the second presupposition, I also take it for granted that the modern theory of human rights and the modern concept of person basically originate from the philosophy of John Locke, the most famous Oxford philosopher in the 17th century. It is not a great mistake because his argument is reflected in the Declaration of Independence in 1776 of America, and the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen in 1789 of France clearly show. I intend to offer an approach to understand the issue of death penalty and the system of punishment by coming back to Locke, namely traditional Oxford. I'm sure that John Locke is still a superstar in the history of philosophy, much more in his hometown, is Oxford. So I want to believe that my choice is suitable in this opportunity. I never think that all aspects and phases of the contemporary theory of human rights perfectly conform to Locke's original argument. The theory of human rights has been modified and changed since Locke's era. In addition, it's hard to say that Locke's view are fully digested in non-Western countries, including Japan, despite the official declaring the respect for human rights. I'm very dubious about that, so I'll mention this point later. In case, I'm going to seek one possible approach towards the death penalty by experimentally coming back to the origin of the theory of human rights. And then I try to find some hints on the reflection of it. The labor theory of rights, this is a very famous argument. Main points of Locke's classical argument about property rights and person, by which punishment is defined, I will explain. Locke's argument developed in the second treatise of government. In order to understand Locke's argument, we must refer to the notion of the state of nature. Locke says, that is, a state of perfect freedom to order their actions and to dispose of their positions and persons as they think fit, within the bounds of the law of nature. On the basis of the notion of this state of nature, Locke defines property rights in this historically famous passage. Maybe this is one of the most famous passages in the history of philosophy. So probably this passage is repeated again and again in any kind of conference in philosophy. So I repeat it. Through the earth and all inferior creatures be common to all men, yet every man has a property in his own person. This nobody has any right to but himself. The labor of his body, the work of his hands, we may say, are properly his. Whatsoever then he removes out of the state that nature has provided and left it in, he has mixed his labor with and joined to it, sometimes something that is his own, and thereby makes it his property. There are cores of Locke's argument on property rights and the concept of person. So this is called labor theory of property. In other words, he asserts that the property rights should be established by our own labor and effort. This idea is easy to fit in well, even with the contemporary notion of intellectual property in the present society, as intellectual property is undoubtedly a kind of rights attributed to creators because of their labor or effort. It's also sometimes pointed out that Puritanism affected Locke's labor theory, but it is not so main point. What we could draw from Locke's labor theory of property is that the property rights are not what is naturally given, but what we should acquire or obtain by our own effort. This point is reflected even in the Japanese constitution. For instance, Article 97, the fundamental human rights by this constitution guaranteed to the people of Japan are fruits of the age-old struggle of man to be free. Or the freedom and rights guaranteed to the people by this constitution shall be maintained by the constant endeavor of the people. This the passage of the Japanese constitution sympathizes with the labor theory of property rights. But probably the most famous passage of the constitution of Japan is Article 9, in which the constitution declares that Japan denounce the war eternally. This is the most famous. But the other point is very interesting. However, this point in the labor theory conversely implies that what is unobtainable because of being given from the outset inseparably from us is excluded from the category of the property right. This is a very interesting implication. Three notes I will raise. Locke's labor theory of property on the basis of the law of nature is developed in the case of the state of nature so that we tend to imagine if the society shifts to the political state, the law of nature cancels. But it is not the case. This is a first note. Second, the concept of property that Locke discusses covers so wide range that most of human rights are included by Lockean property. Although at first glance, Locke's concept of property looks applicable only to property rights in a strict sense. This point is confirmed by Locke's famous phrase, life, liberty, and estate. This suggests that most of all phenomena about rights, including liberty or freedom, are covered by Lockean property. In the context of Locke, all of human rights are described in the form of having, possessing, or owning something. This line of argument can be plausible even in the contemporary context about human rights. For example, H.A.V. Hart once argued that legal rights are nothing but legal powers to require others to meet correlative obligations, and then pointed out that we also speak of the person who has a correlative right as possessing it or even owning it. We can make property rights represent all phenomena of human rights. And although at first sight it looks weird to apply the labor theory literally to any case of human rights, particularly in the contemporary context where there are lots of immaterial properties without the medium of physical labor, nevertheless, we could say that the modern labor theory is intuitively convincing. Actually, the labor theory could be more universally applied than we expect if we take the notion of labor in a broad way. Collecting information or making smile could be a kind of labor. And historically speaking, it is a standard way of thinking that the labor theory is contrasted to the conventional theory of property, which is developed by David Hume. But the conventional theory of property can be subsumed by the labor theory if we take the notion of labor in a broad way. And probably this point I will skip. This point I prepare for the, some points to make the labor theory available or make sense in even in the contemporary context, but this is not the main point. I will skip that. Okay, for instance, the right or the qualification to be seeded in sports tournament, as in tennis or football, this is a very typical representation of the right, Rocky right. The right to be ceded must be gained by making effort to achieve good result. Human rights are intrinsically different from natural existence in the world, like oxygen or hydrogen, so that those are not entirely passively provided. Human rights should be gained by us. The concept of person. There is one crucial point developed in Locke's argument on the right that we should ask a fundamental question about. He says, disposable persons, and we have a property in our own person, disposable person, a property in his own person. Can we on earth dispose of our persons? And can we have a property in our persons? How could we understand law? This. But if we take Locke's argument at face value, the situation is simple. I will confirm two basic points. According to his remarks, it is grammatically obvious that our persons are regarded as object of property rights, probably as well as subject of those. So the labor theory must apply to our persons, and our persons must share common characteristics of property rights with other object of property rights. Actually, we could say, for example, cultivate an attractive personality in English when we take the concept of person or personality to be capable of being improved by our effort. This use of person must fit in well with the labor theory. In addition, our persons can be treated in the same way as other positions, particularly when actors and actresses of music players earn their living through selling their persona or personality. In these cases, our persons are treated as extendable objects, which are even convertible into money. Those persona or personality could be achieved or cultivated by the everyday effort. And Locke sharply distinguished our persons from our own lives themselves. This is a very crucial point. Property rights or ownership is sometimes described as a bundle of rights made of many kinds of rights, like consumability, tradability, alienability, and so on. But we could summarize those by saying that when we have property right in something, we have a kind of power to control or treat those things as we like, in so long as such treatment wouldn't harm others. Without the power, we are simply in the same position as not having those properties. Locke also uses the concept of power when he discussing various aspects of property rights like this. Hoerman, not having the power of his own life, cannot, by compact or his own consent, enslave himself to anyone, nor put himself under the absolute arbitrary power of another to take away his life when he pleases. Or he says, no man can, by agreement, pass over to another that which he has not in himself a power over his own life. On the one hand, Locke founds his labor theory on our property in our own persons. However, on the other hand, according to his remark, he claims we do not have a property in our own lives. What should we deduce from those? I think the answer is very simple. Locke supposes that we have no property rights in our own lives or bodies themselves. Or more exactly speaking, no property rights in controlling and destroying our own lives as a whole. Therefore, we cannot alienate those. He regards our own lives or bodies as totally different from our own persons. Maybe there is a Christian idea in the background. So we, our body, our life, are God's creature. And in principle, we cannot achieve our own lives through our labors. So, therefore, in the context of labor theory, our life is not our own property. So if we adopt the labor theory, our lives or our bodies themselves cannot be our property. Everything with our lives and bodies is not excluded from the category of property rights. However, if we acquire muscular strength by our tough training or gain bodily health by our abstinence, we are qualified to have those results. Actually, we might earn money by means of those results. However, to make our own lives as a whole or to create our own bodies as a whole is fundamentally beyond human control. So committing suicide has been morally prohibited as a crime, particularly in the Christian tradition, since St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas. So for suicide is nothing but destroying others' property, God's property. On the contrary, those arguments of Locke suggest that the characteristics of property rights should be applied to our own persons in contrast to our own lives or bodies. We could consume, trade, or alienate our own property. This point was previously examined along the first basic point. Locke supposes an objection against his claim of impossibility for us to pass our own lives to others, to be slaves. The objection raises the case of Jews who did sell themselves. To this, Locke remarks, but it's plain, this was only to doulagery, not to slavery. Well, it is evident, the person sold was not under the absolute arbitrary despotical power. Obviously, Locke accepts the case that our persons are sold in the same manner as the other object of property rights. However, thus, how could we understand Locke's phrase, life, liberty, and estate? Does he mention life as a representative of our property rights? Yes, he does. We should understand life in this context, not as our own lives themselves as a whole, but as some bundle of bodily functions or abilities which we could gain by my own effort. And use or alienate, probably in a way, compatible into money in principle. And the next point, I go to the talk about punishment. Punishment as a forfeiture. In fact, Locke's argument is so surprisingly consistent that the labor theory conforms to even his argument developed in his another masterpieces, an essay concerning human understanding. Locke discusses the problem of personal identity in his essays, and he introduces the next distinction. To conceive and judge of it aright, we must consider what idea the word it is applied to stand for. It being one thing to be the same substance, another the same man, and the third the same person. If person, man, and substance are three names standing for three different ideas. Man in this case means our biological existence as organizations or lives. His distinction suggests that there must be a clear-cut theoretical difference between a biological life and a person, to say nothing of the difference between substance and the person. Additionally, we mustn't miss the next famous point. He says, we must consider what persons stand for, which I think is a thinking intelligent being that has reason and reflection and can consider itself as itself, the same thinking thing in different times and places, which that it does only by consciousness. consciousness is the keyword to establish the personal identity. Roughly speaking, in the scheme of Locke's philosophy, consciousness is supposed to be connected with an active aspect of our experience to intentionally understand something. In criticizing innate notions, Locke offers the standpoint that our knowledge is gained by our attempt, experiment, or experiences, rather than naturally given, in particular concerning complex ideas and propositional knowledge made of a combination of ideas. Those main claims in Locke's essay perfectly correspond to his labor theory of property right. As the notion of consciousness here implies a certain motivation to experimentally understand something, which has affinity with activity of our labor. Additionally, Locke's distinction between person and life in his essay is exactly the same as his crucial argument in his labor theory of property right that I have scrutinized. How consistent he is. Locke's two treatises of government was published without the author's name, but clearly these two masterpieces are written by one single person. Then how is punishment understood in that Locke's scheme? Locke introduced another concept of right in the state of nature. He says, all men may be restrained from invading others' right and from doing harm to one another, and the law of nature will be observed, which will the peace and the preservation of all mankind. The execution of the law of nature is, in that state, put into every man's hands, whereby everyone has a right to punish the transgressors of the law to such a degree as may hinder its violation. The reason Locke gives for this right to punish others in the case of nature, in the state of nature, is that if nobody has a power or a right to execute the law would be vain. Then how could we execute the right to punish others? Locke stipulates, in the state of nature, one man comes by a power over another, but yet no absolute or arbitrary power to use a criminal, but only to retribute to him. So far as calm reason and conscience dictates, what is proportionate to his transgression, which is so much as may serve for reparation and restraint. And he adds, from these two distinct rights, the one of punishing the crime for restraint and preventing the like offense, which right of punishing is in everybody, the other of taking reparation, which belongs only to the injured party. As to the reparation, Locke gives an explanation like the next remarks. Let the conqueror have as much justice on his side as could be supposed. He has no right to seize more than the vanquished could forfeit. His life is at the victory mercy, and his service and goods he may appropriate to make himself reparation, but he cannot take the goods of his wife and children. In this argument, we should pay special attention to Locke introducing the concept of forfeit. Locke offers here the logic of punishment in terms of forfeit. His argument relies upon such an idea. By performing acts contrary to natural law, one forfeits that portion of one's own right against others that will make an interference in one's own life, proportionate to one's interference with others, morally permissive. So in punishment is defined to be forfeiture of offender's property. This is a kind of retributive equilibrium. Some questions might be raised about how to understand the restraint, but maybe it's possible to skip. Maybe we need to mention that. How should we think about restraint? Could we understand even the restraint as a kind of some forfeiture of offender's property rights? Two interpretations are possible. We could understand restraint as only an emergency treatment of offensive behaviors when those behaviors are really dangerous. And the second, we could understand even restraint as a kind of forfeiture of offender's property rights. the offenders deprived our society of our rights to safety or free action, so that they ought to forfeit or lose their right to safety or free action proportionally. In any case, if we take this second view, we consistently keep the logic of forfeiture to understand the Lockean idea of punishment in an integrated way. Then we step to the next stage, in which I will lay my own viewpoint, but which is, according to my understanding, which is a logical consequence of Locke's theory, which is called impossibilism. I will explain later. Obviously, this view of punishment corresponds to retributivism in the philosophy of punishment in general. But this view is not necessarily opposed to utilitarian idea. Utilitarian ideas can be subsumed by the Lockean idea of punishment, but this, I will skip this point. In any case, Lockean view of punishment still deserves considerations even at present. Moreover, his labor theory of property rights, which constitutes the basis of his view of punishment, is more universally convincing than we usually expect. So I believe that it's one of promising approaches to apply Locke's view to our contemporary problems. And our task here is to apply Locke's view to the issue of the death penalty and investigate what significant perspectives we could draw from that. In the following, I will argue with presupposing that crimes to which the death penalty is applicable are murders. So, it is quite well known that the conflict, retentionism versus abolitionism, constitutes the very core of the debate on the death penalty, but which has nothing to do with the English society, but in US or in Japan, this is a very vivid debate. Some of controversial points in the debate are also well acknowledged. So detentionism claims we human society must take care of sufferings of the bereaved family, or the death penalty is necessary to deter future crimes, or the public opinion strongly supports you. On the other hand, the abolitionism maintains that the death penalty is cruel. In fact, the execution in Japan is made by hanging. So some people think that this is cruel. In US, recently, executions made by lethal injection, or sometimes shooting. It should be abolished as long as there is a possibility for the court to make misjudgment. There is vagueness and arbitrariness between a death sentence and a life sentence, and so on. The debate appears to reach a deadlock. However, those overall debates should be severely criticized as a deception or fundamental mistake if we return back to the original view, viewpoint of human rights proposed by Locke. This is not a complicated argument at all, but rather a clearly logical consequence. I propose a consequence in the form of the indicative conditional sentence. If we accept the theory of human rights in its original sense, we should regard the death penalty as conceptually impossible. As far as we accept the theory of human rights, the death penalty should be taken to be a contradiction, like a round triangle or married bachelor. I want to call this viewpoint the impossibilist view in comparison to the retentionism or the abolitionism. There are three justifications. First, in the theory of human rights, a person is sharply distinguished from life itself, in that we have property rights in our own persons, but we don't have the rights in our own lives, so that it is impossible to make someone forfeit his or her life under the name of punishment. That is defined as a reparation equal forfeiture. This is a definition of punishment. It is logically true that we cannot forfeit or lose anything that we don't have. We cannot lose tails because we don't have tails. how should they understand the actual practice of death penalty executed in countries like Japan, where respect for fundamental human rights is clearly stated? That practice cannot be the death penalty, according to the impossibilism, but the practice is purely violence. That's a strange contradiction in our society. By our society, I mean the countries which retain the death penalty. As far as we accept the definition of punishment based upon the theory of human rights, the reparation equal forfeiture, the death penalty is logically opposed to the definition of punishment because it eliminates the possibility for an offender to make reparation for harmed victims, so that it must be judged to be impossible. In other words, the death penalty should be rather regarded as counter-punishment, as it prevents punishment from being imposed. I believe that it is not so big a mistake I skipped this point, and I go to the third justification. Third, the concept of person found in the modern system of punishment as a basis of a property right is established by consciousness. But this, rather than dying, apart from dying, is by definition what we cannot be conscious of, so that the death has completely nothing to do with persons and any property rights at all. Thus, imposing death cannot be punishment. This is a third justification. Those are crucial points in my today's argument, so I repeat point. The first justification, we don't have property right in our own lives. So according to the Lockean definition of punishment as reparation equal forfeiture, the punishment to deprive lives or kill someone cannot be a punishment. This is the first justification. The second justification is concerned with the consciousness. And third is consciousness, and the second is concerned with the liberation, and the third justification is consciousness. That is to say, according to the modern concept of person, punishment is supposed to make sense only when a punished person can be conscious of being punished. Even as a matter of fact, in the present world, offenders who are insane or suffer from mental disorder are treated as being less responsible for offenses in most countries, including UK and Japan. This fact evidently corresponds to the original sense of punishment, such that punishment should be what the punished can be conscious of. This is definitely or logically beyond consciousness. If we can be conscious of our death, we haven't died yet. The concept of death penalty is a confused or rather contradictory idea. This approach also supports the impossibility. Then, how does Locke himself deal with the death penalty? This is a very interesting question, but how to interpret Locke's philosophy is not my purpose today, so I skip this point. But if we have a sufficient extra time, okay, I can come back to this point. How Locke himself treats death penalty? This is very interesting. So, the last part. Implications of the impossibilism. My proposal, thus far, of the impossibilism of the death penalty is a kind of experiment to apply Locke's original theory of person and the property rights to the issue of death penalty in general. If Locke's theory doesn't deserve consideration at present, my argument is just an anachronism that is not worth discussion. However, the situation is quite different. The Christian tradition, which constitutes the background of his concept of person, still holds lively particularly in Western countries, where many people religiously believe that our lives are created by God, as, for instance, the debate between evolutionary theory and creationism clearly shows. So, the debate between evolutionary theory and creationism doesn't matter so much in this UK, but as you know, this debate is very controversial in the USA. So some people firmly believe that we are created by God, not in terms of evolution. Anyway, in that context, our lives are not supposed to be our own properties. Rather, it's God's property. Additionally, Locke's labor theory of property rights still obtains realistically as well, as the current trend of thinking much of the intellectual property shows. The ground of intellectual property seems to lie in inventors' labor and efforts, as I mentioned before. So my guess is that it is because this Lockean tradition, even if unconsciously, influences Western countries that mostly all of Western countries, including UK, have abolished the system of death penalty. Whereas in other countries with other traditions do not necessarily abolish the death penalty. I think that it's because this Lockean idea affects such a social system. I will conclude my argument with briefly pointing out three implications of the impossibility. First, I emphasize that the impossibility is offered in the form of a conditional sentence. Namely, the impossibility simply claims that if the theory of human rights is accepted or adopted, then the death penalty is impossible. A natural imaginable reaction to this is that how is this view different from the abolitionism? For actually, the theory of human rights are universally accepted, so that is a common default for us. Therefore, even if the impossibilism is presented as a conditional, the conditional is virtually the same as the categorical, unconditional sentence that leads to simply asserting the impossibility of the death penalty. As a matter of fact, this unconditional assertion is not distinguished from the abolitionist view. To this reaction, first, I will answer that the impossibilism claims the death penalty is conceptually impossible as punishment, whereas the abolitionism asserts the death penalty is so morally problematic as to be stopped, when the abolitionism theoretically assumes that the death penalty is one of punishment, even if undesirable. Thus, we should understand that the impossibilism is structurally different from the abolitionism. Second, that reaction makes a misunderstanding concerning the universality of the notion of human rights. As some scholars have pointed out, and as my argument itself in fact alluded, the notion of human rights is basically a Western and Christian view, so that, objectively speaking, that has not permeated all nations of the world yet, even though they officially declared the respect of human rights, like Japan. I'm very dubious about whether Japan has already sufficiently digested the notion of human rights. In this sense, the antecedent in the impossibilist conditional is not the default, exactly speaking. To put it another way, we could, in principle, suppose or consider the different situation where the antecedent doesn't hold true. For instance, as I mentioned at the beginning, public opinion in Japan strongly supports the retention of the death penalty, in spite of the fact that the Constitution of Japan clearly states the respect for fundamental human rights. I imagine that there is a different system of morality, like Bushido, or the spirit of samurai, working secretly and unconsciously in Japanese people. That ethnic view, Bushido, is quite different from the theory of human rights, in that people living with the view pay special attention to dying in a brave manner, although that view is not completely different from the theory of human rights, or to every aspect of human affairs. Hypothetically, if we adopt or revive that maybe pre-modern kind of ethnic view instead of human rights, the antecedent of the impossibilist conditional is rejected. Of course, the conditional is still true according to the standard logical rule, but it loses a practical impact. In that case, the impossibilism might virtually lead to the same position as the retentionism. This is an important implication of the impossibilism. In any case, those circumstances partially explain why the death penalty and the punishment in general must be surrounded by a peculiar kind of ambivalence, which I mentioned earlier. So, second implication. As long as the impossibility depends upon the original theory of human rights, where the system of punishment is ultimately based upon the notion of liberation, the impossibilism could imply the legal system according to which reparation of harm caused by offences must matter the most rather than retributive imposition of physical punishment. That is to say, the impossibilism, although it is deduced from the classical standpoint, tends to support what is nowadays called restorative justice, a new theory of criminal responsibility. This is quite surprising, but natural implication. The impossibilism eventually removes the ultimate punishment because it is not punishment. The impossibilism is a position to consider how seriously harmed each victim is without trying to solve the problem at one stroke by executing offenders. The impossibilism has an affinity with the system of restorative justice to think about degrees of harm in each case painstakingly. The second implication, the last point. The impossibilism conversely opens the door to analyze and explain our psychological tendency to admit a conceptual possibility of the death penalty in terms of retributive schemes, despite its theoretical impossibility. By the restorative scheme, I mean such idea that when a person deprives others of some property, the person must offer the equivalent property. This is the idea of retributive equilibrium, which is basically the same as the Lockean scheme of reparation equal forfeiture. People tend to apply this scheme to the death penalty to justify it. It is, it seems to me, because people really perceive something offered to us when someone dies, that they have no hesitation to apply the retributive scheme in this case. What is offered? We couldn't think at all that the life of the dying person is offered, because it is a completely nonsensical idea. If we suppose that the life of the dying person is offered, who receives the life offered? Does the recipient have the two lives? Offering a life is simply a violation of grammar. Then what is offered? How about supposing that death is offered rather than life? Certainly, the notion of offering death sounds to be more realistic than that of offering life. As actually, for example, we can think that a dead body is given, or some emotions like sorrow, guilt, or so are given when someone dies. Those are quite realistic. However, if we can suppose that dead person offers death when they die, we should, logically speaking, suppose that they own death before they die. Otherwise, they cannot offer death. Hence, the notion of the ownership of death comes up here. In fact, we found it not impossible to think that we are supposed to own death, as far as we can die freely whenever we like. This idea might be compared to an idea of owning marriage as to single people, as they can be said to own a kind of right to marry someone, unlike married people, apart from the society of polygyny. In any case, if we somehow accept the ownership of death, probably we could just keep the retributive justification of the death penalty. A person deprives others of their ownership of death by killing him, irrespective of their own wills, the person must offer his or her ownership of death by being executed. This kind of way of thinking is secretly working in us, affecting many aspects of human cultures. However, offering death is ultimately an irregular idea, as well as offering life, although an idea of offering death is more plausible than that of offering a life. If we are offered death, what should happen? Must we die? So we must note that the notion of the ownership of death is also a purely fictitious idea. But if people believe that they can justify the death penalty within a retributive scheme, it seems that they unconsciously use the notion of this fictitious notion of the ownership of death. This is another origin whence the ambivalence appears unto the death penalty. I stop. Thank you.
The questions are being recorded, so if you don't want your question on podcast, let me know and we'll delete it. So I saw Ingemar, Peter, Steve, Owen. I think you would have your hand up first.
Since I come from Sweden, I can't resist mentioning, if you'd given your talk, lecture 2 days ago, it would have been exactly 100 years since the death penalty was last used in Sweden. And furthermore, it was the first and last time the guillotine was used.
Last time?
The guillotine was officially used in Sweden. It was the first and last time. It's imported in order to be the standard procedure of executing prisoners. But then, the death penalty was immediately removed.
Can you hear at the back? Is it loud enough? Maybe you could speak up a little bit.
Maybe I should stand up.
You could stand up.
Something more philosophical. You point out clearly, correctly, that Locke makes this famous distinction between the person and the human being, or the man.
Life.
So it's quite possible that he would have two different grounds for the right to our person and the right to the body. But I think there's a great difficulty in applying the labor theory as you want to do to the person, but not to the body. And I think the difficulty is the same in both cases. Namely, the labor theory is we acquire property in something by mixing our labor.
Yes.
But we can't mix our labor. You point out we can't mix our labor with our own bodies because we have to have a body, so to speak. But there's the same difficulty in sort of mixing, getting, acquiring a right to the person you are by mixing your labor. We can't do that unless we are persons. But I would suggest that there is a very simple sort of ground on Locke's account, namely that we say the person and the body we have as a gift from God. And if that is a gift from God, I mean, it's perfectly easy to understand how there could be certain strings attached to that gift. God said, I give you this body and mind in order for you to acquire property, but you're not allowed to destroy that property. That is, you're not allowed to commit suicide, nor are you allowed to transfer it to somebody else. That is, you're not allowed to sell yourself as a slave. Furthermore, if you use this property, this gift I've given to you, to destroy the gifts I've given to other people, that is to kill them, you've forfeited that gift. Yeah. So he could have a justification for the death penalty. And some quotations from Locke, you didn't mention him here, but you gave him a, seemed to indicate that he is a supporter of the death penalty. But anyway, what I'm saying is that there seemed to be a sort of rather simpler solution to what could be the basis, the same kind of basis to write to the person and to the human being.
Okay. Such kind of questions always happens in the context of discussing Locke's philosophy. But I like to mention one point again. I quoted the Locke's remark when he... this one. But it's plain, this was only the tragedy, not slavery. Or, for it is evident, the person sold. So, according to this Locke's remark, person could be sold. But the life cannot be sold.
The body can't be sold.
Body is okay. Or body's strength or strength of muscle is okay. But the my life as itself cannot be sold. Or we rather have to say that selling my life as a whole to other is a nonsensical idea, grammatically impossible. So, but Locke himself, person sold. This suggests that person can be sold. So in this context, person is treated as a kind of property. This is very evident. But the life itself, of course, we can sell some muscle or strength of muscle in a physical labor, and we earn a lot of money. We could earn money by that. So in that case, our body can be sold. That kind of remark is accepted, but. This case suggests that person can be sold. So it is radically different from the concept of life itself.
Yes. Early on, you said that you drew an analogy between the death penalty and probability.
Yes.
Suggesting that perhaps, I think quite plausibly, that you can't understand any probability without understanding what probability one is.
Yes.
And that would suggest that you can't make sense of any punishment unless you've understood what the death penalty is about.
Yes.
Now, I find that rather tenuous. I mean, two reasons. Obviously, punishment can take place within a family. You don't expect to be applying the death penalty within a family.
Okay.
And besides which, there would be a real problem were it true. Because if your argument is correct and the death penalty is incoherent, then if you do need to understand the death penalty in order to make sense of punishment generally, that would seem to imply that punishment in general is going to turn out incoherent.
Okay. To the point. It's around my... okay. But as I argued, if we accept the theory of human rights, we have to think that death penalty is impossible. But theory of human rights is not so general. In some countries or some tradition or traditional cultures, the theory of human rights is not dominant. I doubt that the case of Japan is included in such kind of category. So in that case, I will retain my logic.
Okay.
Steve.
So early on, you made the I think correct point that Locke's theory implied that suicide was absolutely forbidden.
Yes.
It's pretty clear that he did. You then went on to give a kind of history of ideas and made the claim that Western countries are still very much in the grip of Locke's theory.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that if at the way in which Western societies have treated suicide in the last sort of 20 or 30 years, they've become progressively more and more liberal about it, have usually legalised suicide, even some of them legalise assisted suicide.
Wow.
So it seems to me that this is prima facie very good evidence that Western countries are no longer in the group of Locke's theory.
Okay. Particularly the same is true of the general problem about euthanasia. So I have heard that some of British people go to Switzerland to have a physically assisted suicide, because in Switzerland it can be conducted legally. But it is a very interesting point. But still now, some people who believe in the Catholic or some traditional branch of Christianity cannot accept this penalty.
Sure.
You mean that?
Well, Western societies in general don't seem to have this strong view about suicide.
Against suicide,
yes.
Yeah, so my argument explains, or my argument turns that aspect of Western countries. I mean, some of Western people traditionally believe in Catholic or some Christianity, then they refuse the suicide as a kind of crime. But recently, as you said, some Western trend changed. But I guess that such kind of change suggest that some trend for Western people to be separated from the Christianity. As far as I know, the Christian percentage of the people who believed in Christianity, for instance, in this UK, is not so much big. So maybe a Western country is in the process of shifting to the other trend. But what I focused upon, the traditional study of Christianity in Western countries. So can I make sense?
That there's a real worry that your theory is no longer applying for all those people in Western societies who are no longer Christian.
Yeah, but I focus on the Christian faith in Western countries.
Owen?
I guess I actually have a related question. I was wondering, because you alluded at various points to kind of standard human rights discourse and universal understanding of this today, but the problem is that discourse is very much secular, right? So the international human rights law does not, one would think, rely on a presumption of a Christian God in this sense. And so this is going to be a particular problem if you try to apply this Lockean theory of the right to life. So you can say if you believe in a Christian God, the right to life is just I have a right towards God, I have a duty towards God not to kill you. But if you don't have a presumption of the existence of God or a certain kind of God, you can't make that claim. And if you can't make that claim, what is the right to life going to be cashed out as? A duty on me towards whom? Not to kill.
Towards whom?
Towards whom? Mm. Whom? Who's the object of that right? If not God, the law can say it's God, but instead of rights discourse today, we're not going to build God into our theory. So who is that object? And if it is the person being killed, I think it would be, then it seems we can get their punishment off the ground. But if not, who is it?
Can I help me to?
So I
cannot perfectly catch what your point is.
The question related to the relationship between the secular nature of human rights and human rights discourse, at least as it's constructed, and the kind of basis or the need for God as a kind of underlying premise for Locke's notion of a right to life.
Yeah. Hmm.
So if you don't have a theist premise about God giving life, then you in the most logical way of understanding the right to life is that the life belongs to the individual, and that you might get a serious punishment from that.
Mm-hmm. It's harder to answer, but probably as Steve raised at one point. Recently, Western people, some of Western people do not consciously believe in Christian God or Christianity. So, but my guess is that at the fundamental level, at the background of Western countries' culture, there is still now some strong stream which derived from the Christian tradition. So, even if facially my argument doesn't apply to the present state of Western countries, I guess that somehow it is valid, even with regard to the present Western countries.
Can I ask you a question about impossibilism?
Yes,
which is
yes.
To be, if I understood correctly, that the death penalty is somehow conceptually incoherent. So you had this slide about the tails. Can you bring up the tail slide?
The tail.
You said we can't have a tail penalty because we don't have tails.
Ah, tail.
Tail. Sorry, it's my English accent. Australian accent. Tail penalty.
He said
it's logically true that we cannot forfeit things. We cannot lose tails if we don't have tails.
Yes.
Well, I'm convinced by this argument. So instead of talking about the death penalty, I'm going to talk about the life penalty. Yes. And we can lose our life. So it's not conceptually, we can forfeit our life. So it's not conceptually impossible to talk about a life penalty where if somebody commits a crime,
we take away their life because
they have a life.
Yeah.
They don't have a tail, but they have a life.
Of course. If we accept a different theory from a theory of human rights, it's easy to accept that we can lose our lives. But I'm talking about the Western theory of human rights. According to the traditional theory of human rights in Western countries, we have to think in such way, we cannot forfeit lives. We cannot lose lives because we have no property rights in our own lives. This is the origin or core of the theory of human rights. But of course, this is one of views. So if we adopt a different kind of theory as to human lives, it's easy to say that we can lose our lives. No, it's easy.
Okay. Yeah.
Two points. The first thing is that I was wondering if your theory can work.
Your
theory, difference between life and the person. Can apply to people who don't believe in this, like Cartesian distinction between res cogitans and res extensa, because if I think I'm just one thing, not divided, that my life is not divided from me, then you can logically deprive myself of the only thing I have, which is myself, life and the person. And the other thing is that I think you were pointing out that it's doesn't make sense from a logic perspective or a grammatic perspective to talk about death penalties. But maybe from a social perspective, from the perspective of the social contract that like Hobbes, Locke, and so take into account, it makes sense to talk about death penalty or life penalty, in the sense that if human beings need a kind of social contract in order not to kill each other. The person who kills other people and then becomes guilty of killing, then is out of the society.
Okay.
So the rules that are in this case, the human rights, don't apply to the person anymore because she's kind of saying, killing someone or doing something really horrible, she says, I'm outside the society, I don't accept your rule, I don't use the human rights. So maybe we have, in this case, a right to not apply human rights to them as well.
Okay.
That makes sense. Oh,
two points.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the concept of self, particularly Cartesian self. But in the context of Locke, the self is the same as a person, not the spiritual substance or Cartesian ego. So self is represented by the person. So my argument about a person cannot be applied to the self, spiritual substance like Cartesian ego. That is my first answer. And the second, this point is concerned with how Locke himself treated this penalty, which I skipped in my talk. This quotation is crucial to answer your question. Every man in the state of nature has the power to kill a murderer, a criminal who, having renounced reason, the common rule and the measure God has given to mankind, has by the unjust violence and the slaughter he has committed upon one, declared war against all mankind, and therefore may be destroyed as a lion or a tiger, one of those wild savage beasts with whom men can have no society, nor security. When people read these remarks, Locke strongly supports the death penalty, but this remark suggests that really suggests that Locke admits the death penalty. There has been a debate as to how to understand Locke's view of this death penalty, but if my understanding thus far about Locke is correct, Locke cannot support the death penalty at all. How can we understand Locke in such a way despite this remark? Locke asserts that the murderer may be destroyed as a lion or a tiger. Could killing dangerous lions or tiger be classified as punishment? I don't think so. That is not any kind of punishment, but simply an extermination of harmful beasts. So this remarks of Locke himself cannot be the ground to suggest that Locke himself accepts the death penalty.
So
Dominic has a question.
Yeah, we got a line. So if somebody has, so Simon was the next in line, and Peter and Ingemar put their hands up. So if your point is on this point, let's take the question.
It's actually on this point.
Is yours on this one, Peter?
Only marginally so.
Okay, is yours on this point? Okay, so why don't we take Ingemar and Dominic, and then we'll return to line. So,
Locke says more than killing a murderer is like killing a tiger, a lion, that quotation. He also says that a criminal has renounced reason and sort of declared war to humanity and mankind and so on, and could therefore be. So he says something more in that. And secondly, I would like to say that on your account it seems possible, although the death penalty seems impossible.
Death penalty is possible?
Impossible. It seems possible to punish people by making them irreversibly comatose. Because in that case, you put an end to the person, which we have a property in it, according to your view. We couldn't replace the death penalty by making people irreversibly comatose.
First of all, I admit that
we're not removing their biological life, just sort of putting
it. What do you mean by not removing the biological life? Could you explain?
Well, if you make somebody irreversibly comatose, you
unconscious.
You make them unconscious forever.
Yeah.
But biologically, they are alive.
So you could destroy a part of their brain, so they keep alive.
Like a brain death, yeah.
Yeah, not quite a brain death, but close.
Sorry, I I have never thought about such case in this context.
Not as long.
Yeah. Okay, I will think about that.
Okay, Dominic, your point is on this.
So, Locke seems to be suggesting that you might destroy a murderer to exterminate them, to remove their future harm, and that seems to relate to the second of the two justifications that he gave for punishment, yeah. Reparation and restraint. So if you kill somebody,
yeah.
You provide the ultimate restraint from them killing somebody else. But it also, on his other claim, which you, I wasn't convinced by your argument against, killing somebody might constitute a form of reparation, because for the family of somebody who's been killed, there is no way that a murderer can repair that loss that they have had, or the loss to the individual, their loss of future life. But on many accounts, inflicting a similar loss to the family of the murderer and a loss of future life to the murderer is a way of achieving some balance, a reparation. So,
no perfect way to make a balance, perfect balance.
I agree. Yeah. But it would seem to count as both reparation and restraint.
Yes, as far as we could, but no perfect method. So that's what I initially described, that punishment includes some peculiar kind of ambivalence. So not a perfect solution can be expected. So, yeah, I admit your point, but don't ask me, because it is not possible to provide a perfectly convincing system of punishment. Therefore, I describe it as an ambivalence. But we have to improve as far as possible. So restorative justice is a new idea, but many people criticize restorative justice as well, because there are lots of drawbacks. But there is no way but to invent some better methodology to keep the system of punishment. So no perfect system of punishment can be expected.
We're drawing towards this, so we'll take last two questions, Simon and Peter.
Okay, I have a quick observation and a question. So the quick observation is, the death penalty isn't logically the ultimate punishment, because, countries that have the death penalty now take great pains to try to inflict any more than death on the criminal. And in past times, there used to be lots of different kinds of death penalty, and some of them were much worse than others. So you can't say the death penalty is the ultimate punishment just on its own.
Oh, okay.
The question is this. It's about your link between retentionism and impossibilism. So as I understand you, impossibilism is this conditional view. It says if this Locke-inspired theory of rights is correct, then the death penalty is impossible.
Yes, that's mine.
And you suggested at one point that if you hold this view... You suggested at one point that if you hold this impossibilist view but reject the Lockean-inspired theory of human rights, that would be somehow related to abolitionism. To retentionism, right? That would lead you to retentionism somehow.
It might lead to.
Okay, it wasn't clear to me why you think that. Why can't you be an abolitionist impossibilist? That is, you hold this conditional view, you think the Lockean theory of human rights is wrong, and you think there are all these other reasons for abandoning the death penalty.
Oh, yes, of course. But in that case, namely, when I refuse the Lockean theory of human rights, the impossibilist view, described as a conditional sentence, might lead to the same as retentionism. Particularly, what I have mind in saying that is the Japanese Bushido or samurai spirit. Mm. In that case, they don't accept the theory of human rights.
So you were just saying it's possible to be a retentionist.
That's right.
Okay. In that case, if the antecedent is rejected,
okay, impossible to be an abolitionist. Yes, yes. Impossible.
And as to the point you initially touched, so many kinds of despenality in the history clearly included something should be fit should be punishment because they suffer some serious pain. But we should distinguish between the death and the process of dying. So process of dying, of course, we suffer a serious pain when in the process of dying, but it is not the core of the death penalty. Death penalty is completed after the death appears. So the process of dying has, conceptually speaking, process of dying has nothing to do with the death penalty.
But doesn't it add to the punishment in those cases?
Oh, of course, of course.
But
that can
the,
be punished.
The extension of his point, a lifetime of severe torture,
I see,
will be worse than death.
Yeah.
So death is not the worst punishment.
But that's another viewpoint, yes. Of course, I agree with you.
Right.
But that's another topic.
Peter, last question.
Yes, I was concerned about your hypothesis that it might be adherence to some kind of Lockean theory which has led to the abolition of the death penalty. Maybe, you know, under the surface, that's been driving people. I just wanted to give three reasons why for doubting that. One is, I think, biblical Christianity, the idea of eye for eye, tooth for a tooth, life for a life, that kind of thinking has been very prevalent. So whether it's right or wrong, people have tended to think of lives as things that can be, you know, matched one for another. There are the passages in Locke where he seems to support the death penalty, and I'm not sure that people have followed the logic of his theory through in the way that you suggest. And even if you do follow the logic through, it does seem to me that, that the death penalty is going to be a special case under any theory. I mean, you know, punishments standardly involve doing something to somebody or depriving them of something such that, that they're in a different state afterwards, a worse state. The death penalty eliminates that. So it's unlikely to be something that people will think of as just the end of a continuum. It's likely to be thought of as a special case.
Yeah.
And just certainly in the British situation, I would suggest that, to my mind, by far the biggest thing has been mistakes. It's been the fact that people have been aware that the death penalty quite commonly led to people being killed who were later found to
innocent,
be innocent.
Innocent, innocent.
And I think that has had a more profound effect than anything else. I suggest so.
Okay.
Any final, do you want to make any final remarks?
Death penalty is a very special case, of course. Yeah. So, but such kind of point has an affinity to Locke's argument.
Okay, well, we should draw this to a close and enjoy the drinks, but I must say that I think this must be about the fifth or sixth of the Hero lectures, and this is the most people I've seen in the last lecture. Normally there is an exponential decline in attendance over the three lectures, and yours has, I think, shown an increase in the attendance.
Let me say one point after before finishing. When I was an undergraduate student at my college, I initially became interested in the Locke's philosophy, and of course I know that John Locke is come from Oxford, so it has been one of my dreams to talk about Locke in Oxford. Thank you very much.
Thank you.